This evening, we are going to hear from Rose and Bert Browning and Jean Cauble, the birds and the bees and the flowers and the trees. I told Rose that she had everybody at the birds and the bees, but that was probably all we needed to say. And Scott wants us to play the song so that to get us rolling. But this conversation, we try to do something each year that has to do with Earth Day and honor that as stewards of God, as those who recognize that we have been entrusted with something wonderful. Yeah. And we were looking at some ideas, and I was moving through websites looking at the Richmond Arbor Group and several other things. We were thinking about trees in particular, and I came across a presentation that was being made in the area by a gentleman who said the way, who talks about native plants as a way of being helpful. And I paid attention to that and thought, that sounds really interesting. And the next thing I knew, Rose emailed me and said, hey, I'm really thinking that something about native plants would be good. And I said, well, you know, when something keeps coming back to me from different places, I try to pay attention. So perhaps we are meant to be hearing about these native plants tonight and the role that we play in helping Virginia and the area around us. So we are so grateful that Rose and Bert and Jean are going to share with us, and they will tell you what they do as far as nature is concerned and how they got roped into this is what I say to them. But before they take over, let's begin with a word of prayer. God, we are so grateful for all of the beauty that surrounds us, for things that are starting to bud out, for warm air and sunshine and clouds and so many ways that we celebrate your creative power and the way that you want us to have nature to enjoy and that it brings pleasure to you. And so God, as we share together tonight, we pray that you will show us some new ways perhaps that we can be responsible in the ways that we take care of what you've entrusted to us. Guide Rose and Bert and Jean now, and we thank you for this time together. It's in Christ's name we pray, amen.
So we are going to start just by briefly introducing ourselves and how we think we might have some right to be doing this presentation. So Jean, why don't you start?
Well, I'm Jean Cauble, and I'm here, I think, because Rose and Bert found out that I was a master gardener. And so we're supposed to know just everything there is to know about the plant world, which we don't, and that's not true. But we do know some stuff. So that's how I got roped into this.
And you're with what master gardener group, Jean?
I'm with Goochland Powhatan.
And how long have you been a master gardener?
About 11 years now.
Okay.
I'm Bert Browning. I was certified in 2014 as a Pocahontas chapter Virginia Master Naturalist, which is a different program from Master Gardener. Master Naturalist covers everything, trees, reptiles, fish, geology, you name it. So if you ever want to do a good 13-week program that leads to certification, try the Virginia Master Naturalist program. There are a number of chapters around the state, about 2,500 active Master Naturalists. And you do a minimum of 40 hours of volunteer work a year and a minimum of 8 hours of continuing ed each year to keep your certification up. It's a great program. I never knew how much I don't know, like Jean said, until I was in that program.
That's right. If you want to find out how little you know about gardening or being a naturalist, just take the training and then you'll realize what you don't know. I'm a master gardener with Chesterfield County, and I've been a master gardener for 5 years. Bert and I both use the term master quite loosely. We would describe ourselves more as enthusiasts than experts, because both of us started so far down the continuum on our level of knowledge that just taking the training just sort of got us to a halfway normal place, but it didn't really get us ahead. So our learning curve is still pretty steep. And I know that some of you out there are probably far more experienced gardeners than I am. So I just want to acknowledge that. But one cool thing about what we're presenting tonight is that we're finding that even some of the most experienced, wonderful, knowledgeable gardeners don't know as much about this particular topic, because actually it's not so much absolutely new, but it seems like the interest in this and the understanding of its importance is just now taking off. And it just keeps repeating everywhere. Everywhere I go, I keep getting bombarded with this, emails and all kinds of opportunities to take webinars. So it is a fairly new thought process that we'll be introducing tonight. So you've already muted yourselves. We will take questions at the end or comments if anybody has any, but don't feel like you have to stay on if you've reached the end of your interest or understanding or what you want to do here. Our goal tonight is to inspire and inform you, and not misinform. So if you ask us specific questions and we don't know the answer, we won't make it up. Okay, we'll help you find the answer, but we're not going to tell you something we don't really know. Also, I did want to point out, with all the webinars that I've been doing in this pandemic here, sometimes there's information on a screen that I'd like to save. And there is, of course, the screensaver option on your computer. But I also find that just simply having my cell phone handy and taking a picture of the screen works really well. So at the end, there will be a resource page, and I would love it if you could take a picture of that and hold on to it, because I am going to make some what I think are wonderful recommendations for things you can do to learn more about this. And that's just one suggestion I have. All right, so we did, as Anna said, she told you pretty much how this came to be. My idea for it actually came one day when I was out in the woods next to our house with Bert, and we were pulling up honeysuckle. And as we were pulling up that honeysuckle, I thought, hey, invasive species, that would make a great program. And almost at the same time that I had that thought, I received information about a webinar series that is being offered by Lewis Ginter and a lot of other groups. They've gone together. They're offering a 12-week webinar series on the use of native plants, and it's all for $10. Six of them are happening now and six in the fall, and they're recorded. So you don't have to be there when they're presented. And at the end, I'm going to show you where you could still sign up for that. So even though we've had four of the six spring webinars, you can still get to them. And the speaker, the person that I'm going to focus on tonight, the information, was our keynote speaker. And if you don't watch anything else, I hope that you will watch his presentation. So I'm going to tell you how to do that at the end. And finally, I want to say that right now I would call myself an enthusiast about this topic, but I'm quickly moving to zealot, which means that when we get back together, you may want to look the other way or walk the other way when you see me, because I'm starting to get pretty passionate about this because I really have come to believe how important it is. All right. So Bert is going to do a quick devotional to get us started.
Yeah. So you get church credit for this. I'm going to read a verse of scripture.
That's right.
Seriously, this is from some of the earliest recorded scripture, Genesis chapter 2, verse 15, from the creation account. It says, "The Lord God took the man, that is Adam, and put him in the Garden of Eden to till it and keep it." Now, some people think that gardening was a punishment from God that came only after the fall. That is not true. Keeping the Garden of Eden was to be a stewardship issue for humankind to join in as a co-partner with God in taking care of what God had created. So what we talk about tonight with native plants and others, this is part of our stewardship. It's part of what it means to be a manager of creation, what God has put before us. And that means it's not punishment, though sometimes it feels like it, like when we're pulling honeysuckle. There's not a lot of fun in that. But this is from God, and it is a commission that we are to till and keep the land.
Okay. All right. To start off, I want to take a quick informal survey. So I'd like you to raise your hand if you would like to see more birds in your yard. Raise your hand. I'd like to see more bees. All right. Okay. How about more butterflies? More butterflies. Okay. Did I see a no from you, Scott? That's all right. Don't answer
no,
that.
No, don't answer.
We'll talk later.
Yes, yes, because there's been an infestation of crows in my neighborhood. Oh,
okay. I can see that. All right. How about more bees? You'd like to have more bees in your yard?
Sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Most of you. How about more bugs? You'd like to see more bugs. Mm-hmm. Okay. I was thinking that might happen. So it looks like we have a little work to do tonight, and that's what's going to get us started. As Anna told you, we're talking tonight about the birds and the bees and the flowers and the trees. And yes, there might even be a little reference to the birds and the bees as we go along. So tonight, I want to introduce you to our real presenter, and that is this guy. His name is Dr. Doug Ptolemy. He's a professor and chair of the Department of Entomology and Wildlife Ecology at the University of Delaware. Much of what I'll be sharing tonight is based on his research and that of his students over the past 20 years. And I have borrowed very liberally from the book that I have pictured there, and also somewhat from his presentation that I heard in the Lewis Ginter in the first webinar that we watched. I don't think he'll mind because at the end of this, I'm hoping you're going to go out and buy his book. So I am promoting his book tonight, and I hope you won't mind that I used his information. Also, I'd like you to know that he has a newer book. It's called Nature's Best Hope. And I also have that book, but I really think this one is better. So if you go out looking for his book, this is the one that I would buy. It's really fascinating. There's a lot of information in there about bugs, which I did not think I was interested in, but that I found really, really interesting. And here come the birds and the bees, including some R-rated descriptions of insect mating rituals that I think you're going to find very fascinating. So we are talking about the birds and the bees tonight. So here's the story of Doug and his and how he came to discover the importance of native plants. About 20 years ago, Doug and his wife, Cindy, bought some property in southeastern Pennsylvania and built a home there. As they were clearing the land, it had been a farm, and they began clearing the land in order to landscape their property. They discovered all of these plants on their property. These were all alien plants or non-native plants. And some of the examples are listed there. Not pictured, they also found Norway maples, Bradford pears, and mile-a-minute weeds. I had not heard of the mile-a-minute weeds, but it turns out we have those in Virginia too. And so he realized that they were going to have some work to do if they were going to plant to make their landscaping look nice. As he and his wife began the labor-intensive process of clearing out the invaders, he had an epiphany. And he realized that no one else had had this epiphany. He studied the literature, and no scientist had written about this. So he realized that he was discovering something that had not been discovered. As he studied the plants or looked at the plants as they were clearing the land, he noticed that the non-native plants, the aliens, showed little or no insect damage. The insects weren't eating them. The native plants, such as the ones that I've listed here, showed the normal damage of plants that have supplied insects with food. They weren't decimated in any way, but they had little holes or little bites out of them here and there, and he could tell that they were feeding insects. And as he studied further and he got his graduate students involved, he confirmed that most native insects cannot or will not use alien non-native species for food. And this was a cause of great concern for him because he knew that alien plants have invaded our national parks, our state parks, our natural areas, our yards. This had become a real problem. And if this continued, he wondered what would be the future of native insects. Now you may be in the camp that the only good bug is a dead bug. And I have to admit that when it comes to being inside my home, that is exactly my philosophy. If you're a bug in my house, you're going out of here one way or the other, either on a stretcher or in the coffin or whatever, but you're not staying in my house. I try to be a little more generous when I'm outside, but sometimes we've had some issues with ants that got just too carried away, or some very, very aggressive hornets that we had to deal with. So sometimes we feel that way about bugs as well. But after this presentation, I hope that you're going to have a different thought about bugs. So as gardeners, we generally think that no insects are a gardener's dream, right? Because we spend a lot of our time trying to figure out what kind of bug we have, what to do with it, how to get rid of it. But there's a problem with that. So many animals depend partially or entirely on insect protein for food. A land without insects is a land without most higher forms of life. And a study from National Geographic in 2019 found that 40% of insect species are in decline around the world. And I thought about this. Have you noticed that in the last few years, when you go on a trip at night, there are far fewer insects on your windshields? I remember the first time that we went on a trip and came back, and we both commented, huh, it's interesting. There just aren't as many insects on our windshields as there usually are. And that is probably because there are not as many insects out there. And you still may be thinking, oh, well, great, fewer insects. Humans are totally dependent on ecosystem services. Ecosystem services from plants produce oxygen. They clean water and slow its journey to the salty sea, reducing runoff. They capture carbon and pump it into the ground, which helps keep it out of the atmosphere. They help prevent floods. They dampen severe weather. Ecosystems from animals, which includes insects, provide pest control, pollinate nearly 90% of our plants, and disperse plant seeds. And a famous ecologist, E.O. Wilson, once said in 1987, actually, insects are the little things that run the world. So what we may have been considering a problem actually turns out to be these insects actually turn out to be really important to our ecosystem. If insects were to disappear, and I am going to warn you, there's some bad news coming here. If insects were to disappear, most flowering plants would become extinct. This would seriously alter the physical structure and energy flow of most terrestrial habitats, which would lead to the collapse of the food webs that support amphibians, reptiles, birds, and mammals. That would be us. The biosphere, which is basically the Earth, would rot due to the loss of insect decomposers. And just to put it mildly, humanity would be doomed. Not that we don't have anything else to worry about. But there is good news. We can save the birds, the bees, the flowers, and the trees, all of nature, by making mostly simple changes in our own backyards and encouraging others to do the same. And this would be a good place to interject that I'm kind of getting ahead here, but I want to make sure I say it. Doug Ptolemy's idea is that for too long, we have depended on conservatories or like conservation areas and parks and all of those, thinking that that would be enough to protect our ecosystem. But based on what he has studied and learned from his research and what he knows about the decimation of natural areas all over the world, including our continent and country, he realized that it's going to be up to individuals to do something about this if we are going to save the insects and basically all of nature. So what can we do? Well, the first thing that I have pictured here is a pollinator garden. I would like to tell you that this is my pollinator garden, but I would be lying. It is not. I don't have the kind of sunlight in my house, in my yard to grow these kinds of flowers. And even if I did, I doubt that I could do this. But we know that butterflies are one kind of insect that most people love. I don't know anybody who says, I don't love a butterfly. We all love to love butterflies. So tonight we're going to focus on the butterfly, but it's really important to realize that there are lots of other bugs that are also very important to our ecosystem. The lowly ant, beetles, dragonflies, moths, which I really have to say, moths and I have sort of a love-hate relationship too, especially when they're in the house. But these are all important insects for protecting our, keeping our ecosystems going. And just to briefly talk about, if you are in a position to grow lots of flowers, you probably already know this, but a variety of flowers is really important. So I don't have quite the variety pictured here that I would like to, but different insects require different shapes based on their tongue. A lot of insects, especially butterflies, like a place to land where they can rest and conserve their energy. So the wider blooms are good for them. There's a spiky plant back there called liatris that's probably good. I know the birds love my liatris and they like to pick the little seeds out of them, and things that hover may find interest in those. So having a variety of flowers is a really good thing to do. And also the thing that's really important here is to realize that flowers are just one thing though that is important for insects. And in elementary school, I know that we all learned about the stages of the butterfly, but I found that I actually needed to review that in order to understand what was going on in my yard. So we're gonna review it real quickly. The butterfly lays its egg on leaves. The egg turns into the larva or the caterpillar, and the caterpillar, depending on the species, will form a pupa, or some of them go underground, and then that hatches out and we get the butterfly again. And it's really important to realize this, because this reminds us that the larva, the caterpillar, has to have something to eat when the egg hatches out. And here's a little bug humor that I thought I'd throw in just to look at that. Okay. All right. So here's an example of how important it is to have something for that caterpillar to eat. This is a monarch butterfly, and that was our lantana last summer on our deck. And lantana is not a native plant. It is actually, it is somewhat invasive in some parts of the country, but it doesn't seem to be a problem here because of our cold winters. So the lantana is the favorite flower of the butterflies in our yard. But that flower is just one thing that the monarch butterfly will need in order to reproduce. Because monarch butterflies turn into this. They turn into caterpillars. And perhaps you have seen caterpillars on your plants and thought of them as nuisances. Or I know that I had a little fight going with some caterpillars that kept eating my tomato plant. And then I realized that they turn into a lovely hummingbird moth. So I had to figure out what I was gonna do about that, because I had been disposing of them rather rapidly. But we actually need caterpillars, and this is why we need them. First of all, of course, we need them to make more pollinators, obviously. They provide food for birds, rodents, and predaceous, which I learned that word is meat-eating insects. And this one is really important, and Doug Ptolemy goes into lots of detail on this. Most baby birds cannot eat seeds or anything like that. They have to eat soft food in the form of worms or caterpillars. They can eat other types of worms, but the caterpillar, ounce for ounce, has the most protein and other nutrients that a baby bird needs than any other type of worm. So without caterpillars, without delicious, wonderful caterpillars, we would not have baby birds. We have to have them. And the thing about that is that we know that the butterfly population has been greatly reduced in the last decades. So the fewer caterpillars we have, the fewer birds we're going to have. And there is a direct relationship. In a year when there are good when there's a large population of caterpillars, they can study and see that they end up having a large population of birds that year. So what can we do to have more butterflies in our yards? Well, as we've already said, we can provide food for them. Now, you don't have to have room for this much of this kind of pollinator garden. I don't have room for that, but I can grow small amounts of plants around my yard. I have lots of pots on my deck because that's one of the places that gets just barely enough sun so that I can grow some plants that require sun. Some people will say, oh, I've got this covered. I've got a butterfly bush. So how about the butterfly bush? Well, it turns out that the butterfly bush is probably not your best choice of things to plant. First of all, it is invasive. It is not on our list of invasives of the most concern in our area, but in some parts of the country it is. But it definitely spreads by seeds and can become a problem. So it is invasive. I heard on one presentation that the quality of the nectar may not be all that great. And more importantly, food is one need that that butterflies have, but they also have to have a place to lay those eggs. The monarch butterfly, as most insects are, the plants that it needs are very specific to that species or that variety. The monarch butterfly requires milkweed. And this is not a plant that we typically put in our flower borders because we think they're so beautiful and wonderful and we want to have them. And it used to grow quite in nature, in natural areas, but because of the decimation of our natural areas, there's not nearly enough milkweed around for the monarch butterfly. So as responsible homeowners, making a place to grow milkweed is one thing that we can do to support the monarch butterfly. So what's the big deal about aliens, about non-native plants? It turns out that alien or non-native plants have been imported all around the world, like other countries import our native plants. And this has been going on forever. Like, it was really a fun thing to do in the 1700s, the 1800s. One advantage, if you want to call it that, to non-native plants is that because they don't appeal to native insects, they often come, they're advertised as being pest-free. But the reason they're pest-free is because the native insects don't eat them. Sometimes, unfortunately, they come with their own insects attached, their own alien insects. And that is the case of Asian azaleas. And it's hard to break the news to you, but our lovely azaleas that we all plant in our yard are not natives. They actually came from Asia. And I don't get worried. I'm not going to tell you you have to get rid of your azaleas, but I just want to point out that the lace bug that often bothers your azaleas is an alien bug that came attached to the azaleas. Some of them come with insects and diseases that damage our own native plants. And that's probably where we got Dutch elm disease and chestnut blight because of imports. And as I've already said, most insects are specialists. They lay their eggs on particular plants or plant families because those are the plants their larvae eat. In most cases, they cannot adapt to get nourishment from alien species. And when these alien species escape cultivation, as many of them do, they end up replacing our native trees and our shrubs and plants. And therefore, we no longer have the plants that are needed for nourishment. And one interesting thing I learned was that plants, often when they're first brought to this country, they can be very docile, lovely little plants that don't do anything, but something will happen over the years and they will escape cultivation. And they think that was true of Japanese honeysuckle, which is the traditional honeysuckle that everybody has lovely childhood memories of, you know, stopping by the woods and getting your dose of honeysuckle. That is Japanese honeysuckle that at one time was fairly docile and well-behaved, but is not any longer, and Bert's gonna talk about that in just a minute. I also wanted to take a moment to show you this slide because this is an example of an alien insect that was just discovered in this country, in Pennsylvania in 2014. It's called the spotted lanternfly. It is a real concern to everyone. It likes fruit trees And it has now been found in the Winchester area, the Shenandoah Valley, where the apple trees grow. And it is very, very damaging to fruit trees. It is now in 5 counties in Virginia. And one of the projects of Master Naturalists and Master Gardeners is to try to educate people about this insect. And also, I'm actually have just volunteered to be part of a team that's going to monitor the Tree of Heaven, which Bert's going to talk about in a minute, to look for this spotted lanternfly. If you see this, it's a very distinctive, especially the one on the right, that nymph form, and the adult, which is the one in the middle. If you see this anywhere and you can kill it, please do so. If you can collect it dead, it doesn't need to be alive, that would be great also. But you need to report it to the cooperative extension in your area, because this is a great concern, and therefore I wanted you to be aware of it. But this spotted lanternfly came in from Asia, probably either on plant material or possibly in just imported goods that came in on a ship. And now we have it, and it's a real concern. Now, contrast the what I just told you about alien plants with what with native plants. This is the white oak, which Doug Ptolemy considers to be the number one most important tree in our landscape. And because Bert and I are not really good at identifying things, we did not know until last week that we actually have one of these in our yard, we're pretty sure. These oak trees are the ones that keep their brown leaves all year. I mean, keep their brown leaves in the winter. And I have been this person who said, that is such an ugly tree. Can we just cut that down and put up something nice, you know, like a crepe myrtle or something? No. Thank goodness I have a tree lover here who has never let me do that. And so anyway, we have this tree. And we're pretty sure it's a white oak. If it's not a white oak, it's pin oak, and that's really good too. But the white oak, the Quercus alba, I don't know if I said that right, is the host tree for 557 caterpillar species. And contrast that to the crepe myrtle, which is probably host plant to nothing, okay? So this is something to let you know. And I just took this picture right out of Ptolemy's book, just to let you glance at it. These are all native trees on the left that you see there. If you have any of those in your yard, you can give yourself a pat on the back. And this just shows you on the right how many species are supported by these native trees. I do want to say, though, that if you have a weeping willow in your yard, you don't get to pat yourself on the back, because I was really disturbed to find that weeping willows are not native. Isn't that sad? But there is a native that looks a lot like a weeping willow. It's called a black willow, and I'm going to show you a picture of that soon. But this just gives you an idea of how many species are supported by these native trees. All right, so Bert is going to do a quick little rundown for us of the bad news about invasive species, because this is really his area.
Yeah, all you have to do is walk around Brandermel or Pocahontas State Park, or maybe any natural area near you, you're going to see honeysuckle, which is on the left here, or you see lots of English ivy. Now, we don't think this English ivy that's growing in Brandermel, we don't think anybody planted that. That is probably the result of some well-meaning homeowner having English ivy in their border somewhere, and birds or whatever, other insects, something have taken seed or whatever and got near these trees. And the next thing you know, a well-meaning homeowner who says, oh, my English ivy isn't hurting anything, I keep it contained. Well, the birds don't know that. They spread this stuff around. And on the far right, you see a tree that is just about to be completely decimated, smothered by English ivy and honeysuckle. Tree of Heaven on the left is a misnomer. It is definitely not a heavenly tree. It is highly invasive and can take over a forest. We've done a lot of removal at Pocahontas State Park of Tree of Heaven. Where once it gets started, it can take over a forest and crowd out other native plants. You don't want to have that happen. The multiflora rose, which is very pretty. This is one that's on the walking path we often take in Brandermel, is not native. And it too, as you can see, can take over a habitat. And you don't want to have that happen either. Japanese stilt grass is the bane of the existence of Pocahontas Park. It is all over the place. and it crowds out everything, every other kind of ground cover, everything else that would grow out of the leaf cover on the ground. So Japanese stilt grass is an invasive. Bradford pears, which I dearly love, that's a beautiful photo on the right. Bradford pears are invasive. And if you've noticed, as you ride down any interstate or four-lane highway or two-lane highway these days, you will see lots of these in bloom. Many of them were not planted like the ones on the right. They are growing, big thanks again to birds, that their species is being propagated in places where they are crowding out other native species. Parrot feather is something we see occasionally here in the reservoir at Swift Creek. You may see this in the edge of a creek, a lake, or a pond. It's really pretty, and when you see it, I want you to rip it out and kill it. It is highly invasive. It will completely take over the surface and the undersurface of any body of water. And you do not want this to, as cute as it is, you do not want it in your water.
And I read when I was looking for this picture that it is aquarium grass, just like hydrilla, which we have in the reservoir now, sadly. Mm-hmm. And probably the way it gets into fresh water is people dump their aquariums into mm-hmm. their aquarium. You know, they dump it out in fresh water and it makes its way there and then it just travels. Mm-hmm. So that's how it spreads. So that was the bad news. I wanted to tell you that there is good news because we're going to show you soon of some things you can do to help here. So here's a question for you. What do these plants have in common? And on the left, you see an azalea, hosta. You do see some ivy. You see a Chinese holly in the middle, crepe myrtle on the right. Some hydrangea blooms, which actually were at one time attached to bushes. Some knockout roses. There's a cuba. There is a spirea. So this is what they have in common. They are all non-native alien plants found in Rose's yard, which is the bad news. The good news is most of them, not all, but most, come under the category of do no harm. They are not, for the most part, invasive for now. They are quite lovely in the spring and sometimes in the summer, depending on the plant. Some of them probably do, the ones that have flowers, probably are providing some nectar for pollinators. And in our case, because we live on Swift Creek Reservoir, some of them are holding the soil so that we won't have as much runoff into the lake. So they do have some benefit. But then I have these plants, and this is what I call the oh dear category. First of all is Nandina, and I'm just gonna have to say right up front that I'm having to pray over this Nandina because I really do like Nandina. I like the berries, I think they're very pretty, but unfortunately Nandina are kind of becoming the bad guys of our landscape, and that's because of the berries, mostly because of the berries, which are dispersed by birds and causing them to be invasive in certain areas. Plus the berries are very poisonous, especially to the cedar waxwing, which gorges on them and it can kill them. So it's not getting a very good review these days. This one was new to me and it's when I started the webinar series. This is a rosy glow barberry. We used to have three, now we only have this one. And frankly, it's been on my get rid of list for some time, but not because I didn't realize it was invasive. I just wanted a different bush there. Turns out that barberry is becoming really invasive all along the East Coast. It does have berries which are dispersed by birds, and it also has really wicked thorns on it. So when it invades an area, it's really hard to get rid of, just like that multiflora rose that Bort showed you. It has terrible thorns, and it creates these thickets that are very hard to get rid of. And finally, we have the English ivy. Now, I have a little story to tell about the English ivy. The English ivy that's there under that light, I think is very sweet and charming, and I have loved it. And there's another one on the other side of the sidewalk just like it. The ivy got there when it escaped from that pot that you see, when I used some ivy in that pot one time. And I let it escape because I realized how charming it looked. But I always said to Bert, now Bert, if I die suddenly, it is your responsibility to make sure that this ivy goes nowhere except right here. And if you ever sell the house, you have to promise me you'll pull the ivy up because I don't trust anyone else to keep the ivy in place. And I thought by doing that, I had all my bases covered. But then I found out that it's not that simple. And Bert sort of mentioned this. So about a month ago, I took on the task of pulling up the honeysuckle in a natural area up the street. I started pulling it. And as I was pulling it, I looked behind a tree, and the picture in the middle is what I found. There was English ivy, just a small little patch of it growing in that natural area. I looked around, I didn't see any ivy anywhere else. There was none in the yards that were adjacent to it. There was none running under the fence from the yard there. And I realized that that ivy had not come from the yards. It had come because birds had planted it when they, you know what birds do. And so they had planted that ivy. And if I had not discovered it when I did, it would have taken over the natural area. So I ripped it up mercilessly, and I will keep going up there and looking to make sure that it does come back. But sadly, I'm going to have to get rid of that ivy, that charming ivy around my lamp, because I realize it's not as simple as I thought it was. Now, if you are one of those people who has a large bed of ivy in your house, in your yard, and you want to get rid of it, it turns out that you can mow over ivy numerous times, and eventually you can kill it that way. So I just want to throw that out in case you are feeling convicted to get rid of your ivy. So the problem with my plants, as I said, none of those plants are host plants. Some of them are invasive and destructive. So what do I need to do? Do I need to bring in the bulldozer and get rid of all of those plants? Well, the good news is I do not. So as I mentioned, we live on Swift Creek Reservoir, and we need plants in our yard. And we thought that we were required by Brander Mill to leave trees, as many trees as we could. We were allowed to clear for view, but we took out all of the understory, the native understory that was on our in our native area, and the herbaceous layer. We got rid of that. We thought we were doing the right thing then by planting other more attractive things. So we planted all of the azaleas, we planted ferns, we planted lots of different things. But now we realize that that really isn't enough. Yes, we managed to hold the soil, but we've gotten rid of much of our native understory, and therefore we did not leave much for the native insects. So here's a plan that I have. For that ivy, I have looked up some options, and I found this charming little native plant called partridge berry. And I even found a place where I can buy it. So I'm going to pull out that ivy and I'm going to plant partridge berry. And if I happen not to like it there, the worst thing that can happen is I'll dig it up and I'll put it somewhere else. But this will give me another charming plant around my light so that I don't have to have that ivy anymore. I also am going to work on the herbaceous layer in my in our natural area. And my good friend Jane brought me the plant on the left is called Green and Gold, and it is a lovely native plant. I've got Jacob's Ladder now, and I've got Woodland Phlox. So in the last couple of weeks, I've added three native plants to my herbaceous layer. I had a Daphne, which is not a native bush that I loved, but it died all of a sudden this summer. So we can consider it a problem, or we can consider it an opportunity. And I'm going to consider it an opportunity to plant a native bush in its place in our natural area. Also in my yard, I looked around and I said, well, where else could I add native plants without having to get rid of the plants I already have? On the left is a little dogwood tree that we just planted last year. And I can make that circle bigger. The grass never grows, but so well there anyway. So why not get rid of the grass, which by the way, is one of the things we should be trying to do. Get rid of the grass around there, enlarge that circle and put some native plants in there. In the middle, I have another tree that I have liriope around, which is not native at all. How easy would it be to enlarge that circle? Again, the grass does not grow well there, as you can see, plant native plants there. On the right, this is the side of our yard next to the natural area that is beside our yard. I've always wanted to do something with that. I've always thought a screen would be great because that gray line near the back of that picture is a road. So I'm glad I never got around to doing anything, because now I've left myself an area where I can add native, tall native bushes for screening, shorter shrubs, and herbaceous layer to add native plants to our yard. So in general, there's just some ideas. Plant red maple instead of Norway maple, because Norway maple is an alien plant that, because of it, the shade, crowds out and damages other native plants. Plant a black willow instead of a weeping willow. Plant inkberry, serviceberry, winterberry instead of Chinese holly or nandina, depending on where you're growing those things. They don't necessarily make great foundation plants, so that might be another story, but those are great additions to your yard. Plant Joe Pye weed instead of butterfly bush. And there are several varieties of Joe Pye weed for height and all of that. Plant scarlet honeysuckle, which is the native honeysuckle, instead of Japanese honeysuckle. And if you have Japanese honeysuckle, do everything you can to get rid of it. And this is a good place, and you'll notice I'm talking fast because I know our time is getting short. There are native versions of lots of non-native things. And so it can be really confusing. If you go to the nursery, you can't just ask for honeysuckle. You have to know what kind of honeysuckle you want. You can't just ask for viburnum because there are native viburnums and non-native viburnums. And there's examples of that in so many different plants. And at the end, I'm going to show you a book that's going to help you with that. So what if you don't have a yard? Well, this is the black swallowtail butterfly. And on the right is its magnificent larva. It turns out that the black swallowtail butterfly eats members of the carrot family. And now you're saying, oh, great, she wants us to plant carrots. Well, the good news is parsley is in the carrot family. So if you don't have a yard or you don't have a lot of space, you can plant a few pots of nice flowers for pollinators, a nice big pot of parsley. And if you're lucky, you might see caterpillars on that parsley that will turn into black swallowtail butterflies. And I actually had this happen in my yard a number of years ago when I was still too dumb to realize what it was on the parsley. But fortunately, I left it. And now I know those were caterpillars for the black swallowtail. All right. So Jean is going to do and I'm not just telling her that she said it was going to be quick. She's going to do kind of a quick little run through of native perennials that you can use that are very spectacular. I do want to add something here though before she starts, and that is that Doug Ptolemy says basically to a butterfly or a pollinator, flowers are flowers. So you don't have to get too hung up on the actual flower that you would get from a native plant, because butterflies will accept non-native flowers as long as they meet their other needs. But the cool thing about planting native perennials is that oftentimes they also serve as host plants. So that's why that's really important. All right. So Jean, are you there?
Yes.
All right. I'm going to get you started here.
Okay. What I'm going to show you are just basically close-ups of a lot of native flowers. And I know Rose hit very much on the importance of butterflies. Our number one pollinators are bees. And so this is what you need the flowers for. And I will tell you that some information that I have received recently on the importance of this and why people are so upset about bees diminishing is that without them, about 80% of the food we eat would not be available to us at all. So it is very important. Okay, first flower over there on the left is phlox. It blooms in the summer. It grows about 2.5 feet tall, blooms all summer long, and the bees and the butterflies are crazy about it. It's a sun-needing plant. On the right is woodland phlox. Woodland phlox needs to grow in the shade. It's shorter, and it blooms in the spring. The reason that is so important is that sometimes the bees are out before the summer flowers bloom, and without something that blooms in the spring, like the trees that bloom, they won't find anything to eat. The story I have to tell is that a couple of days ago, I was looking out my kitchen window and I have some azalea bushes under the window, and there was an orchard bee. And he was just going back and forth, looking all over those plants, trying to find something to eat, but there wasn't anything in bloom yet. Okay, next one. This is Rudbeckia or Black-Eyed Susan. This is a native, and this is the way it looks. It's really pretty. It forms large bunches. The plant forms large bunches of flowers on top. It blooms starting in mid to late summer and blooms all the way through till frost. Next is Columbine. Columbine blooms earlier in the year. It starts to show up about the middle of the spring, and it'll bloom into the beginnings of summer. But it's another flower that the pollinators just love. And this is red eastern columbine, which is the native variety. On the right is Lobelia cardinalis, which is a very well-known plant. It's one of the most beautiful red flowers that you can plant. Again, it's another plant that once it's in bloom, you'll see pollinators all over it. It blooms a little bit later in the year, so it's a mid to late summer plant. And it's a plant that will grow in the sun, but can take a little bit of shade. All right, Baptisia. This is Baptisia australis, and this is a native. It grows up to about, it can get as big as 3 feet tall, and it does spread. It's not an uncontrollable spread, but you'll give a nice big area of it without too much trouble. This is an early bloomer. It blooms mid-spring into the summer. Now, Asclepias. Asclepias is your butterfly weed and your swamp milkweed. The Asclepias is on the left is the butterfly weed, and it's named quite aptly because butterflies cover it in the summer. It blooms about, star blooms about midsummer and goes into the fall a little bit. On the right is what's known as swamp milkweed, which is another Asclepias, a little bit different color. But, and if I'm not mistaken, Rose, it's a host plant, is it not?
I think it is, although yeah. I think it will grow here. I think you can, I was trying to remember which kind I have. I think mine is not this kind, because I think mine is orange. Okay. Well, but I think it will grow here.
The swamp milkweed you usually see in either this pink color or white. Mm-hmm. And then the butterfly weed is normally orange, but there is a lot of new cultivars out that go into a lot more yellows and things.
And these are the ones that the monarchs need in order to lay their eggs.
Yeah. Okay. This is Echinacea. A lot of people know it as cone flower. It's another plant that the pollinators like a lot. It blooms during almost the whole summer. It may need you to cut off some of the dead leftover seed pods so that it'll keep blooming, but it's a long bloomer. On the left is Delphinium. Some people know that as larkspur. It's one of the true blue flowers that are native flowers. It's got, a composition and a size and a shape to it that pollinators really like. Mostly grows in long spikes of flowers that grow kind of up the stalk. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of it doesn't have a long blooming time, but it's a summer flower. On the right, On the right is Physetigia. Physetigia, some people call it obedient plant. I've never heard that name before, but that's one of its common names. It's a late summer bloomer. It starts blooming end of July into August. And those spikes, the plants open at the bottom, the flowers open at the bottom, and they just keep blooming and opening all the way up through the top of that long spike. So it has a fairly long blooming time. But again, the pollinators love it. And this is Helenium. Helenium is known as sneezeweed. I'm not quite sure why. But anyway, it's sort of a daisy kind of flower. It only comes in its native variety in that yellow. If you were to see it in a nursery, you would find it in all shades of oranges and reds and mixtures and that kind of thing. But in its native state, it's always yellow. And it starts blooming in about the midsummer, and it will bloom all the way up to frost. So it's a nice long bloomer for pollinators when other things have died down already.
And I happen to have read why it's called sneezeweed. It was once used for making snuff.
That's unbelievable.
Yep, that's why it got its name.
There are interesting, I learned the scientific names of these plants. not the common names, but in looking up some of the common names, just in case people would know them better. Some of them are just unbelievable. The delphinium that we looked at a little while ago has a common name of vomit wort.
Oh dear. Oh dear.
With about 7 or 8 other common names. Who cares?
The colony says that it's a concern that so many of these natives are given such unappealing names like sneezeweed or the swamp milkweed or whatever, because people think they don't want them, but they're really great plants.
Yeah. Okay. On the left is liatris, which Rose spoke about. That's a really gorgeous plant. It stays kind of contained. It grows that long spike of flowers, and that's the true color on it. It's absolutely beautiful. It is a common name for that. Some people call it blazing star, and usually by July into August, it's in bloom. On the right is potentilla, and this is a fairly small plant. It's 1 foot tall or less, and it blooms all summer long from spring to fall. And it's always covered in all those little yellow flowers. Mm-hmm. Cool. Solidago. This is what people think I know of as a goldenrod. Goldenrod is not the flower that makes you sneeze in the fall. That is something entirely different. But it's native and long about the end of August, you start seeing it all out in the fields everywhere. And it's a beautiful plant. And again, once it's in bloom, it's covered with bees and butterflies. On the left is Mertensia. Mertensia is known as Virginia bluebell. And it's a fairly small plant, gets to be about 1 foot tall. When the buds start to come out in the beginning, they're pink. And then as they open up, they change through lighter pink into blue. It's another spring bloomer, which is good for those pollinators that are out already and the summer flowers haven't bloomed yet. It is a shade plant. It does not like to be in the sun. And then Astilbe. Astilbe is another shade plant. Astilbe starts to bloom late May into June. These days you can find it in probably 15 different colors. But that's like the original color that is native. Now, it doesn't have to be flowers to feed the pollinators. These are two native trees that again are blooming in the spring when pollinators first come out and your summer flowers are not available for food for them. And that's the eastern redbud on the left. The one on the right is called amelanchier or serviceberry. It's a beautiful tree. It's covered in white flowers. You don't see very many of them around here. And I don't know why people haven't latched onto those, but they're really beautiful when they bloom.
All right.
Okay.
Are you good?
I'm good.
All right. We're just about done. So here's to sum it up. These are some of the things Doug Ptolemy would like us to think about. First of all, he'd like us to try to shrink our lawns. Try to cut it in half if possible. And I gave you some ideas for how you might do that with enlarging the circles around your trees. There are some plants that are more important than others that are more ecologically productive. And so if we can only plant a few, he would like us to plant those specific ones. And if you buy his book, he will tell you what those plants are. He wants us to reduce lights at night. So if we have a security light, use a motion sensor so that it does not run all night. Lights are a prime cause of insect deaths. And say no to professional mosquito spraying. And if your son is in this business, I apologize in advance, but he says that professional mosquito spraying really does not do any good. In order to address a mosquito issue, you would have to kill all of the adults, and mosquito spraying does not do that. You need to, instead, work on the larva, which you can address. So this is what he says to do. You fill a bucket with water, add straw, allow it to ferment, and then you get a mosquito dunk from the hardware store and you put it in it, and it will not harm anything else, but the mosquitoes will lay their eggs there and it will kill the larva. So that is what he recommends that you do. And I cannot wait to try that this summer to see how it works out here. All right, so also we need to change the paradigm. Instead of, oh no, something's eating that plant, we say, oh look, something's being fed. Now, we do want to give a disclaimer here. There are things like azaleas where those Asian lace bugs are eating your azaleas, and you may have to do something about that. But when nature is in balance, the insects will also be in balance, and they will not decimate all of the native plants because they instinctively know that they need those. So keeping our yards or getting our yards into balance will help with our insect issues. Also, instead of thinking, thank goodness there are parks to preserve nature, we need to start thinking my space can be a homegrown national park. We need to do all of these things, most importantly, because we need to preserve the ecosystems if we are going to preserve insects and life itself. So these are some things that we can do. We can become missionaries. We can spread the word about this, have conversations with people, help educate people. If you live in a subdivision, an apartment, a senior living facility, you can still, no matter where you live, you can still be an advocate for the concept. If you can't do any of these other things and you're physically able, you can volunteer. You don't have to be a master naturalist to volunteer for the James River Park System or Pocahontas, any of our state parks. You can help control invasive plants. And by doing that, you will help preserve the ecosystem, which is really critical. But you also, and I have to admit, I had to shamelessly put in this picture of our grandson because I think this is one of the coolest pictures that our kids have ever taken. Our daughter captured this picture at the playground one day when Ben discovered this frog. And I just think that expression is probably one of the best expressions of wonder I've ever seen. So we definitely want to save our ecosystem so that we can, we definitely want to do all these things to save our ecosystem, but we also want to preserve this so that our children and our grandchildren and their children and grandchildren will be able to savor the wonder of nature. And I really am finished, except I want to show you these resources and I'll talk really fast. There's a wonderful website called plantvirginianatives.org. And I was going to show you that website, but I'm not going to go to it. I can let you do that yourself. But on that website, you can buy the book to the right, Native Plants for Virginia Capital Region. And it is the best resource for telling you what kind of native plants to plant in what particular areas. And that's what I have been using as I have been going into the nurseries looking for things. And that's how I'm planning some of the things that I will plant in our yard. So it's $8.50. That's the shipping cost, basically. And if you go to plantvirginianatives.org, you can order it from there. You can also find the Landscaping with Virginia Natives webinar series there. And last time I looked, which was just a couple days ago, there were still spaces available for that. For $10, you'll have access to 12 webinars and you will have access to the recordings. So I highly recommend, if there are still spaces, that you sign up for that if you're interested in this. I already mentioned Bringing Nature Home by Doug Ptolemy. If I haven't said enough to convince you tonight that this is something you need to think seriously about, or even if I have, but you want to hear Doug Ptolemy, underneath Bringing Nature Home is a link for a talk that I found on YouTube that is almost the same talk he gave for our webinar series. So I would like to highly recommend that you go to YouTube and watch that series, that presentation. It takes over an hour, but it is fascinating and inspiring. Also, there is a website, Virginia Native Plant Society, that has lots of cool information in it. If you don't already have iNaturalist on your phone, it's a free app from National Geographic. It's totally safe, but it's helpful for identifying plants and animals. And I use it a lot to try to figure out what some plants are and if they're invasive or whatever. Doug Ptolemy has a website, Homegrown National Park, where people send in pictures of their yards and what they've done to change their yards over to native plants, which is really interesting. Also, on the Plant Virginia nursery.org website, they listed some nurseries that offer native plants. And I, interestingly, all of them were in Chesterfield. So Sneed's, which is in Bon Air, the Great Big Greenhouse, which is near the mall, and Cross Creek Nursery, which is also not too far from the mall, are three nurseries in our area that do at least have small sections of native plants. And I did find out from Sneed's that if I want a native plant, they can help, they will order it for me. But there are also some websites where you can go, and some of those are listed also in that plantvirginia.org website. I also found out from Sneed's that they have a program called We Plan, You Plant. So if I can't figure out how I want to landscape those areas that I'm hoping to turn native, for a fee, and I don't think it's too large a fee, they will help me plan that. And that is on my list of things to possibly do.
Rose, one question.
Yes.
We had talked about native plants at one point and about the nurseries that have them. And mm-hmm. then there is a potential that we're going to need to be aware of what's a Virginia native, because some places mm-hmm. will sell plants and call them natives, but they might be native to Kentucky or
Kalamazoo. California. Sure. And that is true. And that's why that capital plant guide is really, really important, because it lists Virginia natives. So that's what I'm using as the basis for my plans. I'm going to go with that guide. It is such an interesting guide. I have read that thing cover to cover like three times now. It's so interesting, and they give you such wonderful information about it. So the two things that I would love for people to purchase is Bringing Nature Home and that capital plant guide. And that will tell you. Also, I have found sometimes they make mistakes, because I bought a plant that one of the both nurseries, Sneed's and Great Big Greenhouse, called native. And when I look it up, it is not native. So anyway, they can. Oh, and one other thing, the nurseries are still selling all kinds of invasive plants. So when you go in there, you're still going to be able to buy. I was very disappointed in Southern States. They had an entire pallet of English ivy for sale with no sign saying, hey, this is not a good idea, but we're going to sell it anyway. You know, they should have some disclaimer, which Sneed's did. Sneed's said, only plant this in containers, which is still not really a good idea, but at least they said it was invasive. So you have to be careful about that too.
It goes underground, you know it up.
Yeah.
Do others and I know have it's questions late. Or comments?
Yeah. And it's thank 8:15. You so much. Oh, this is great.
No, you're welcome.
I have a question.
Okay.
Is there something we could or should be doing at our own church campus?
There is. I have a picture. We have some issues at church. I have a picture of side by sides. There's the does no harm and the invasive. There's a leather something mahonia.
Leather leaf, yeah.
Yes, leather leaf mahonia, and it's right next to an akuba. On the side of the church. And the akuba is doing no harm, but from what I understand, the leather leaf mahonia is invasive, but it's not on the watch list. So it's a little confusing what's something you need to immediately address and what's something you just need to pray over. So
yeah. We didn't even mention bamboo, which would be, you could do an entire seminar just on bamboo. Yes.
Yeah. You know, the youth went out to clean up the side yard where the guy next door has planted bamboo, and he came out to make sure they did not mess with his bamboo. So they had a line, and they cleared out the bamboo that was on the church property, but he didn't want to touch it. And that's so sad, because there are so many wonderful plants that you can plant for screening. There's no need to plant bamboo, which is,
There's also a wide variety of invasiveness plants. Some will take over every space they can get in a very short period of time. Some are a little better behaved, and if you want to take the time to cut them back every year around the outside edges so that they become small again, that'll hold down a lot of them. But some of them, and I've got to have some stuff that neighbor gave me, four little teeny plants about 4 years ago, and they were beautiful. And so I planted them, and in these 4 years, it has covered most of my yard, has gone into the woods, and probably I would say covers an area of about 100 by 100 feet from four little teeny plants. And I have tried everything, including really hand feeding them glyphosate and it doesn't kill it. So there you go.
Yeah, and the worst offenders are the things with berries. They're the ones that are really the problem because they get dispersed and you don't even know that they're invading, you know, because they've got
this. This particular plant spread by rhizomes, and also it had, in addition, it also had flower spikes with tons of pollen that stood way up on the top of the flowers. So any little breeze just blew it everywhere.
Could I ask, would you talk about what is a sunny site? We've got some parts of our property that have sun, direct sun, for maybe 5 or 6 hours a day. Is that considered a sun environment, or is that a shade?
Yeah. Can I take that one?
Yeah, I was going to tell you too.
Okay. When something says full sun, it needs a minimum of 6 hours of sun a day. You will find a lot of plant tags that will say sun to part shade. Usually what that means is it will take morning sun, because morning sun is not as strong as afternoon sun. But in the afternoon, it would need to go into a shaded area, or it's something that at some point during the day has some light filtered shade above it. If it says full sun, that doesn't mean it won't grow if it's not in full sun, but it won't do its best thing. It won't have as many flowers as it normally would. It will get more leggy, all of those kinds of things. And of course, there's plants that really do need to be into shade. And if they get afternoon sun, the leaves will scorch.
And that capital guide will give you lots of good information. And sometimes with the native plants, I noticed it'll say this plant is highly adaptable. You know, it can work in sun and shade, which I really loved, because I have a very difficult yard sun-wise. I have this places in our yard where it gets too much sun for shade and too much shade for sun. And it's really hard to find plants to grow in those areas. So I'm kind of looking forward to trying some of these natives to see if they would work.
Yeah.
Donna.
Hey, Rose. Good to see you.
Yes, it's good to see you.
I've got the guides and I've listened to the webinars. I haven't heard anybody talk about clover as a grass alternative, which is what we have been using in our very small front yard where we couldn't get grass to grow very well. And it's taken off. It's done very well. I'm hoping it's considered a good plant. The other thing I haven't seen anything about are beneficial herbs other than parsley. And I do have a parsley bed specifically for the caterpillars. Mm-hmm. So can anybody talk about clover and good herbs for pollinators?
Well, Jean, are you on that? Or do you want me
to? Yeah, clover can be invasive. It does spread.
Yes.
Now, it doesn't wildly spread, but it will spread if you don't keep it in control. The bees, to my knowledge, I've never seen any butterflies on clover. Again, though, butterflies like to feed on things that are up in the air. Bees will go down to the ground and feed on things that butterflies won't go down to, but the bees really love white clover. But it can get away from you if you're not aware of the fact that it does spread.
And I know it's used as a cover crop.
Yes.
And I think it add nitrogen to the soil?
It does. It does. Yeah.
So I think I would think, because you know, grass, before we started adding all the chemicals and things, clover was just a very natural part of our yards. And most, you know, old fashioned yards had plenty of clover in it. And I think it's probably a very good thing, but I'm sort of guessing on that, but just what I know, what little bit I know. Yeah. And beneficial herbs, I'm trying to think what I've read, Donna. I'm trying to think what I've learned about herbs that I know I read that oregano, there were three herbs, oregano, thyme, and maybe dill are liked by, or do they do something for pollinators? But
actually dill is along with parsley, Queen Anne's lace, and the carrot family.
Yes.
Yeah, so I anyway, I was thinking that I could plant more herbs as well.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I'm going to do that too, Donna.
If you have a deer problem, definitely plant herbs.
Yes. Yes. They don't like lavender. I know that.
They don't like lavender. They don't like thyme. They don't like basil. There's a lot of stuff they don't like.
Yeah. And there were several natives in that guide that they say deer don't eat. So that might be encouraging to some of you with deer issues.
I was very impressed. You all really very, very impressed.
Quite a fire hose, wasn't it?
Yeah. Wonderful. Yeah.
Well, I will tell you, as a teacher, it was always harder for me to take lots of information and condense it. I was much better if you gave me a little and told me to expand it. So taking all of this information and trying to find a way to fit it into this PowerPoint was quite the challenge. So anyway, but I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it a lot.
Thank you.
Rose and Jane, there was a sort of a ad or meme or something that came across Facebook probably 2 months ago. It was sort of popular that talked about don't deadhead plants and not cutting them back. Can you talk to that?
I can tell you what Doug Ptolemy said, and Jean, if you want to, you go first and I'll tell you what Doug said.
Okay. Some plants have to be deadheaded or they won't continue to bloom. And I'll explain a little bit about that. That flower bud comes up, the flower opens up, it gets pollinated, and then it grows the seed. Once it starts growing seed, it puts all its energy into the seed formation because that's its way of making sure it comes back next year. So when you allow the flower seeds, the seed heads to stay, it's going to stop producing flowers so that it can make more seeds. And there are a number of plants, and you can look them up. It's easy to look them up, but you could get anything online. Just Google anything having to do with flowers, and it's there. But you can find out which ones really require deadheading and which ones don't have to. As far as why don't want to do it, I can't imagine, with the exception of late bloomers who have their seed heads available for birds in the fall. Mm-hmm. Now, there is a lot of talk about not mowing down all your dead plants in the fall because they will provide seeds and protection for birds during the winter. But before I got into that do not deadhead, I'd make sure that plant didn't need deadheading in order to continue blooming.
The other thing, David, is the things, and I have a lot of things in my yard that have these little tall, almost look like straws. You know, they're the shape of straws. Insects burrow down in those, and that's where they live for the winter many times. And I just saw a webinar last night on bees, and the lady was talking about a lot of the insects will be living in there. So in the old days, in the fall, we would clean up our borders and beds, and we would pull all of that dead stuff up and put it in the composter because, you know, that's what we thought we should do. So one thing they're saying now is that's the kind of thing. Leave those tall, dried out things that look like dried up straws, because there are a lot of insects in there. And if you have to take them up, bind them together and find a way to prop them up. You don't want to lay them on the ground. You want them to be propped up. But Doug Ptolemy says that this is a little bit of a myth because there's really no one time that is right for insects. Like there are whole different cycles of insects. So if at some point when you get ready to redo that bed, you know, like now, you're going to have to clean that out to some degree, and you're probably going to destroy some insects that have not yet come out. So you're not going to be able to save all of them, but for sure in the winter time, leave those things and leave them in your beds as long as you can. And that way you will help out some insects who are living down in those dried up things.
If I can add to that, one of the speakers said, take those dried stalks and maybe get a tomato cage. Mm-hmm. Or I'm thinking I have the circular plant support that has a grid in it, and just put it someplace in your yard where it won't be that noticeable, and put those dried stalks in there if you feel like you really need to clean up your yard in the spring.
Yep, I heard that too, Donna, thank you.
Well, I am so thankful for the input and the questions and the interest of everyone who is a part of this evening. When you get some new things in your yard and take out some old things, you call us. We'll want to come see what you're up to, or at least report into us and let us know of the progress. I am thinking about some places where some herbs could go and a Nandina bush that I can get rid of.
Mm-hmm.
And begin making my way into this as well. I certainly do see the importance and value of it and think how great it is to contribute.
Yeah.
Can I say one thing I forgot to say on azaleas? There is a native azalea. I just want everybody to know that. So when you can, I don't know how easy they are to find, but that's on my list of things to do, is to plant a native azalea.
Yeah. They're not easy to find, but you definitely don't want to go in the woods and dig one up. That's against the law.
No. But I think Sneed's can order one for me. So I'm going to try to do that.
Very good.
All right. Well, thank you all
for being here. And thank you so much, Rose and Bert and Jean. We are so grateful for your sharing this evening. And we may just be reaching out to you with additional questions that we come across as we venture into this and tiptoe in.
Yeah.
Sounds like a
clip.
Thank you.
Very impressed and inspirational. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Bye, everybody.
Bye. Thank you.